We have had such a wonderful day with Mac Lynn. Mac and Marty are with us. Marty's, wave your hand again, Marty. There she is. I want you to be sure to meet Marty also. And we have some folks here tonight I know that weren't here this morning, and we'll do a little more of an introduction again tonight. But Mac Lynn has taught at Harding University and David Lipscomb University. He's presently the Chancellor of Nations University that he established with Dick Eady. This university is established, it's for a resource and internet resource for continuing education for missionaries, for their families, and for their converts. Mac and Marty have traveled around the world, some 40 countries, assisting missionaries in their work through the use of WEI, World Bible School, and Nations University. He's well known for his lectures on Islam. We're just delighted to have him again tonight. Now, he's doing a three-lesson series. He usually does many more lessons, and he said he might come back sometime if we're just really nice to him tonight. Now, he didn't put it that way, but he'd be willing to come back sometime in the future to expand this series. But there is a website you can go to, and at the conclusion of our service, we're going to put that website on the screen and the places you need to go to there, and you can get the written information that you're seeing on the slides here, plus a lot more information. But without further ado, Mac.
Thank you, and good evening to each of you. Choose to be down here because it's more of a class situation and I can be present with you. We'll try to leave some time at the end for some questions as we did this morning. For the benefit of those who may not have been here this morning, we're studying about Islam and its contrast to Christianity. But primarily we're looking at Islam as a system. Now that divorces it from your next door neighbor, where you may have some impression of Islam from somebody who is really kind and helpful to you, but somehow you just don't wrestle with the whole system to which that individual may subscribe. So it's the system that we're talking about. And Muslims are like Christians. They subscribe in different numbers and to different degrees. So being a Muslim does not necessarily mean that you press the envelope as far as you can. Some are very secular in their approach to it. And we had a guide in Iran who said, I'm a Muslim, I don't know much about it, but I was born in this country, so, you know, I'm born a Muslim. And so sometimes it runs in a very shallow way, and sometimes it's very deep. You get up to the imams and the teachers, and you get up to the leaders, it runs pretty deep. But we're going to talk about the diversity that is in Islam. Islam is a very complex issue. We can simplify it by just saying, well, there are five pillars to it and that's it, but there's a lot more to it. And this morning we took up a word. Anybody remember what that first word was that has to do with oneness? Can you remember your Arabic? Tawheed. It means oneness. So in Islamic concepts, everything is one. There's one God, no associate like Jesus. And that one God has created the universe. He has had a will that he gives to man. It's given repeatedly, and man has lost it or has corrupted it. But finally to Muhammad, he gives this final revelation called recitations, contained in a book now, written down, but not written down for some time after Muhammad's death. But this will of God becomes what is impressed on everybody. Now, if God creates everybody and he wants them to follow his will, those who do not follow his will are his enemies. God loves those, Allah loves those who love him. Our familiar statement is, God loved us while we were yet sinners. God's love extends to everybody, but not in Islam. It is for those who respect his will and who do it. Therefore, those of us who lie outside of Islam are the enemies of Islam, and there can be no peace between those who are the friends of God and those who are the enemies of God. The peace that the Muslim has is peace with Allah, not peace with you, the infidel. Now that's sort of a summary of what we did this morning. We're going to look into the diversity of it, though, and see how that works. Islam begins with a quest for power. Doesn't most everything start that way? And as we look at the people who are involved in it, I think we probably should conclude that it's not necessarily religious. I mean, power-hungry men are not necessarily religious, but power-hungry men often use religion in order to boast their ambitions. So what I'm trying to do in the very beginning is to say, you can't just isolate the religious part of it. It is involved with man's ambition. It is involved with politics, with social concerns. It is a complex entity. I would venture to say much more so than Christianity, because it has so many traditions and so many interpretations. So it is diverse, but we began with this quest for power because given the nature of Islam as being the oneness, and everything works well when everybody does the will of Allah as revealed to Muhammad, it doesn't work well when people don't follow the will of Allah as revealed in Muhammad. So power is involved intimately in it as trying to extend the will of Allah so that all will go well, especially for the Muslim, because he now is being judged because you, the outsider, is not behaving. You're not behaving. You're not following Allah's will. Therefore, there's the urgency to evangelize and to bring things under control. And if you live within a Muslim country where the will of Allah is the will of the land, as in Sharia, Sharia being the name of all of Islamic law, if you're living under Sharia, then certainly if you're an unbeliever, there are certain handicaps. You pay a tax and you don't get certain positions. You're a secondary citizen. You don't amount to as much. And so power plays into it in the actual beginning and concept of Islam. It's not just that one individual uses Islam to enhance his power, but the individual who is a Muslim senses an empowerment to extend Sharia law to all who exist, whether they are believers or not. So that's a different beginning place than in Christianity. Now, those who supported Ali, who was the cousin and son-in-law and one-time successor of Muhammad, he was of a particular lineage that linked him, Ali was, that linked him with Muhammad. Now, that's an important concept because it's going to help explain how the Shias and the Sunnis got separated. So we're dealing with the family of Muhammad, who, I'm struggling here tonight because I'm trying to cover so much, and I realize I'm leaving out so much history, which is essential to really putting the picture together. But I'm going to compact that. There are those who were the followers of Allah, of Ali, excuse me, let me start again. Those who were the followers of Muhammad, who accepted his teaching, his recitations, and his sayings, how he explained the application, sort of like a commentary. And they were in the way of Muhammad. So they were in the way of the Sunnah, the way, the path. They followed Muhammad. Therefore, from that being in the path, they were called Sunnis. Being in the Sunnah path, they were called the Sunnis, the followers of the path of Muhammad. Hence the word Sunni, which comes down to us today. But there was another group who were the Shias, and they disagreed. The Sunnis did not believe that whoever succeeded Islam, whoever succeeded Muhammad ought to be certainly a prophet and didn't necessarily have to be part of the family. He just had to agree to the Sunni, to the way of Muhammad. Nothing special. Whoever wanted to be, could be. Whoever was accepted, could be the leader. Well, when Muhammad died, they had this discussion as who should be the leader. Now, if Muhammad is the last prophet, we certainly can't have a prophet. There is nobody who is going to receive additional revelations. So this leader is going to have to be very different. The question is, why do you need a leader? Well, because when Muhammad died, things started falling apart. And you had to organize, you had to bring them back, you had to go out and collect them again. You had to impress upon them the sunnah so that they would continue. So they decided upon the name of Caliph. Let's have a person who will be the leader, and he then is the Caliph and is the leader. So there were several people who were vying to be the leader, and I won't go into all of that, but the ones who came out on top were by and large his close associates. But the fourth caliph was Ali, who was the cousin and son-in-law of Muhammad. He married Fatima, his daughter, and so he was in the family, not a direct descendant. So those who thought that the people who were the family of Ali, who were specially favored, that these should be the leader, then took up the party line of Ali. And Shia simply means of the party of Ali. So they separated from the Sunni, those who were in the path, and said, no, we can't just have anybody being the leader. He's got to be of the family of Ali. Therefore, they became known as the Shiites. Now, the way they divide over the world is about 15% are Shiites or Shias, and the other 85% are, you know, Sunnis. Now, that's a simplification because that does not explain all of the divisions with Islam or all the diversity that is there. But it does explain a major rift in the camp and differences that exist between them, and is the answer to some of the conflict that exists even today. Okay, neither the Sunnis nor the Shias have a recognized leader. When the caliphs came into being as the leader of the Sunnis, they existed for a long time until the demise of the Ottoman Empire in World War I. In fact, before World War I, the caliphate had been reduced in its power and it was not all that greatly functional. But at the end of World War I, the caliphate came to a conclusion. Now, you will hear today on the news about ISIS reestablishing the caliphate. That's an important concept. But that left the Sunnis without a particular head, without any particular leader who could call the shots. Nothing like the Pope of the Roman Catholic Church. And on the other side of the Shias, they had what were known as imams. Now, the difference between an imam and a Shia and Sunni is significant because in the Sunnis, the imam is sort of the preacher of the congregation. The head of a mosque would be, he'd be an imam. But in Shiite religion, the imam is a very different character. He's not only the head of a congregation, mosque, but he is also an individual who may have had some revelations or may have had some insights, or he's a special individual. He's got some powers there that are not admitted in the Sunni and in the main path. Now, one problem is that the seventh imam evaporated and then the 11th imam evaporated so that the Shias themselves are separated as to how many imams they really have. But the key to this is that the imam's going to come back someday, and we look for him to come back and reestablish his leadership. And then the other side, the Sunni side, they're looking forward to the bringing back of the caliphate. So neither one of these will answer the problem that exists between the two major sects in Islam. Sunnis and Shias do differ in their concept of leadership, as we just explained. They will also differ on who's coming back, this Mahdi character figure that's going to return someday. Now, Jesus will also return, and at that particular point, everybody will convert to be Muslim. See, he won't return, you know, as the head of Christianity. He returns as a Muslim because Jesus was a Muslim. That is that everybody in the line of submission to Allah is a Muslim, is one who submits. That's what the word means, to submit, and a Muslim is a person who submits, Muslim, as we talked about this morning. So when Jesus comes back, there will be this conversion. But there is this Mahdi figure Who is going to return? Now you can say, well, maybe that's Jesus and maybe that's not Jesus, but still there's that figure out there who's going to return. We're not quite sure what all is going to happen when that comes to pass, but it does not solve the Shia-Sunni problem. Between the Sunnis and the Shias, there are also differences as to what is the source of their religion. Now, all of them accept the Quran. That's the primary source. But then underneath that are the sayings, and the sayings among the Shias is not exactly the same as the sayings among the Shiite. The interpretations. Now, the Hadith, which is the traditions, the sayings of Muhammad, is really a collection of what either Muhammad said to his immediate followers, or what somebody heard from an immediate follower that Muhammad had said, or what somebody heard that somebody heard that somebody else heard that Muhammad said, this is the meaning of this particular passage. Now, there is obviously an end to that sort of thing, but they disagree on where the end is and what is to be included. Now, among the Sunnis, there would be the acceptance of a form of understanding Islam from comparison or consensus, analogies. So this thing goes on. Where it comes to a conclusion is individual interpretation, where there is free thinking. And when there got to be in history some more free thinking about Islam, and you remember this morning we're talking about the living constitution concept, when that sort comes in, then they said, no, that's too far. We've gone far enough. So Islam is really the consequence, not of just the Quran, because there are no Quranic Muslims, but of the Quran, plus the traditions, plus the consensus, plus the analogies, and stop at the individual interpretations and individual explorations and bringing it forward. So when we talk about restoring Islam, it's not the original Islam. It's restoring Islam as reflected in the first few centuries up to the point of the Ijtihad, or the freedom movement that was there. So you see, we're still into deep water in terms of getting this thing together. There are some other matters in which they would differ. One, for example, the temporary marriages. There is a problem in Iran today, which is Shia country, with immorality. And Ahmadinejad, the past president, did recommend on occasion that the young people practice more of the temporary marriages. The way that works is, now this is Shia, the way it works is a man goes on a trip. He's already got three wives, and he can have up to four. But he goes on a trip, he gets lonely, and he can bring in somebody, marry her for the night, for 24 hours, 48 hours, however long he needs her. And then at the end of that time, he can say, I divorce you, I divorce you, I divorce you, and there's no immorality. So, you know, there are ways of dealing with human situations with Islam they don't talk about. But Ahmadinejad did encourage more temporary marriages so that there wouldn't be the high rate of immorality. There are a lot of ways to skin a cat, right? Okay. Now, among the Sunnis, we only Shias alone, okay? But we're going to look at the Sunnis, the majority of the 85%. There are presently four schools of thought. And when you hear discussions going on about that is Islamic, that is not Islamic, one of the questions you want to ask first is this Shia or is this Sunni? Or what school are you talking about? Because there will be the differences. And here's a list of the schools on the left, and then there are the countries in which they are most dominant. These schools of thought are really the customization of basic culture. They don't necessarily differ greatly in terms of interpretation, but there are methodological differences that exist, interpretations of specific texts and traditions. But more important than that, there is the tendency to be more open or more literal, not liberal. The Hanbali school, for example, gave birth to the Salafist movement. You may hear that word in the news today. You don't hear it very often. But if you talk to a Muslim who is from the Middle East, he will know what you're talking about if you talk about the Salafists. They extended the Hanbali emphasis on the literal, the exclusive, the puritanical interpretation of it. And when they talk about the puritanical, the object of going back to, again, it is not to Muhammad. It is to this period of time that follows Muhammad, to a particular medieval point in which Islam had developed in its spread throughout the Middle East. This movement, this more literal movement, is set to restore Islam to the first three generations, purifying it of all innovations, of superstitions, of deviances, of idolatries, and it thinks of other Muslims who don't agree with them as having committed shirk. Now, you know what shirk is? Somehow that is denying the principles, denying the oneness of God, that would be attributing Jesus as the Son of God. Anything that is a deviation from what they think is Islam. It's sort of like a person who in a particular church or religious groups thinks everybody else is lost except for them. You get the point now, right? Okay, so in Islam, this literalist group, this is the way. It's a pharisaical type of person, but this is the way. And this Salafist group is very active, and it is a departure or coming out of the Habili experience. Now, look at the bottom, Wahhabis and ISIS. You have any idea who the Wahhabis are? Who?
Arabs.
Which Arabs? Tom? Saudis. Saudi Arabia practices a sect of Islam by one particular school, and these followers are called Wahhabis. Now, Wahhab was an individual who was a Muslim cleric who wanted to restore Islam to an earlier form. He and Saud got together, and Saud conquered most of Saudi Arabia, and that's why it's called Saudi Arabia. Okay? And the form of Islam in Saudi Arabia is the Wahhabi form. That's where you got the cutting off of the hands if somebody steals, see? Whereas, you know, most Muslims never heard of that, maybe. But you've got a certain school of thought, which is very literal, that has been in place now for a couple of hundred years by the Muslims in Saudi Arabia. And their concept of Sharia, or their law, is the constitution of that country. And that's why Saudi Arabia, which now has lots of money, is building mosques all over the world and is spreading Wahhabism all around. Now, let's see, something doesn't sound quite right here, because Saudi Arabia is our best ally in the Middle East. But they're the most radical, literal, fundamentalist of all of the, shall I say, mainstream Muslims in the Middle East. Okay, did you catch that? That they are in the mainstream. But Saudi Arabia has trouble with ISIS because they're more extreme than they are, but they're in the same category. But in Saudi Arabia, the Wahhabis, now they do have a few Shias over on the other side that they have to deal with once in a while in some uprisings, but the majority are Wahhabis. And the Saud family is very protective of its position. Do you understand now why some of these Muslim countries like Saudi Arabia are not opening the doors to the migrants from Syria? It's all about power, isn't it? And I guess maybe a question is, why would a Syrian Muslim want to go to Saudi Arabia? Now, I can't resist, you know, this is history, this is not politics, this is history. But at the time, you remember when the Russians came down to Afghanistan before we got involved? We only got involved after they got out and said, we can't do anything with this place, that we can. But anyway, we were on the sides of the Mujahideen fighting against the Russians, and then we got on side of bin Laden and sort of the Al-Qaeda group fighting against in Afghanistan against the Taliban, who were more, you know, radical, they were more literalists too. But all the meanwhile, Saudi Arabia is pumping money into that part of the world, and they're trying to create madrasas and schools and also teaching to bring about the conversion of people to their brand. Now, they were teaching Muslims, but it's a matter of bringing them over to Wahhabism, and they do this all over the world. And I'm not saying that every mosque in this country is built by Saudi money, but I am insinuating that a lot of Saudi money is flowing around and building mosques across the world. But not everybody is Wahhabism. Not everybody welcomes Wahhabism. They welcome their money, but they don't necessarily welcome that. But ISIS is an extension of the same ideology. So when somebody says, ISIS is not really Islamic, well, who's talking? Well, evidently somebody who's not an ISIS interpreter, or somebody who's not a Wahhabi interpreter. But he may be a Muslim and still hold to the major concepts. Now, if you say, and this is in kindness, certainly it is. But if you say that, okay, this is not Muslim, or a Muslim says that is not Islamic, the individual, when the individual dresses with a covering, when the individual goes to Friday prayers, when the individual celebrates Ramadan, he is admitting that he is in concert with the major themes and central doctrines of Islam, which means there's one God, he has no associate, Jesus is not the Son of God, that the will of Allah has been given through the one prophet. That's a confession that he makes. Muhammad is the prophet, and God is only spoken through him, and that is the will that should come to everybody, and those who do not come to that will are less than friends of God. You see, it all ties together. So you can try to run, but until you deny the centrality of Islam, you're still Muslim. And in Muslim theology, you cannot leave the faith. Now, you can commit shirk and, you know, you do lose the faith. But in Muslim theology, once a Muslim, always a Muslim. All right, got my preaching out of the way there. There's another group called the Sufis. And the Sufis are, they're mainly over in Central Asia, from India and so on, and sort of been influenced with Buddhism, and et cetera. And so they're more of the spiritual type, looking for the spiritual, the purification of the inner self, with the goal of experience with God, which doesn't sound, you know, too Islamic, but yet it is. They're Muslims. The holy places, Mecca, Medina, certainly, but in Kazakhstan, there's another place, which is the third holy place for the Sufis. So I just had to throw them in, though we never hear much of them. They're certainly not involved in the skirmishes that are there. Okay. Now, coming more to our present day, there are a lot of political movements. Keep in mind, Islam is not just a religion. If it were, it'd be easy to deal with. But religion is a political, it is a social movement, it is all-encompassing. The will of Allah is all-encompassing. All you need is Sharia law. You don't need a constitution, and you don't need democracy. Democracy is the enemy of Islam. Islam is the enemy of democracy. Now, I guess you have to define what democracy is. Oftentimes when you hear on the news that the people have voted, then they mean, we have democracy. That means that everybody got to vote, and they got the purple on their finger to show that they voted. That's democracy. That's not democracy. Because even Saddam Hussein, when he was in control of Iraq, he got 98% of the vote. Somebody asked him why he didn't go 100%. He said, well, that wouldn't look too good, would it? He could have gotten 100%, but he didn't want the 100%. So he got 98%. And now in our democracy, you know, if you get 51%, we think that's wonderful, you know, half the people went out to vote. But really what is implied in a democracy is that people come together and make the laws. Now, we have problems in this country as Christians because we don't think some of the laws ought to be made. We have objections to the law, but we live in a country of law and rule where, as the people come together, they can vote on an issue, they can vote on same-sex marriage, and it is agreed to by the people, it's agreed to by the Supreme Court, so it's the law of the land. That's the way democracy works. Now you see why democracy won't work in a Muslim country. Can't do that. Because Allah has revealed His will in all aspects of life, politics, social, relationships with people, and everything that you do. It is all-inclusive. It is Sharia, totality. So democracy is the enemy of Islam, and Islam is the enemy of democracy. And when we go to a place and, quote, bring democracy to the people, what we're satisfied with is that they have the right to vote. Look what happened in Egypt. They had the right to vote, and who did they vote in? Voted in the Muslim Brotherhood. And then we were chagrined at that, were we not? What are we going to do? Because now they have used the tactic that we have promoted, and they have gotten even things that are worse. The Muslim Brotherhood started in 1928. It started in Egypt, and it is the largest of all of these groups, being old, being powerful. It was voted into office. The president lasted a year. The military threw him out. He's now in prison. So we're back to where we were with Mubarak. But it is a very influential organization, the Muslim Brotherhood. And if you hear about it, they are more interested in the political than they are in the theological. But they are interested in reestablishing the caliphate. Now, there's another group that's over in India, not quite as old, but it's sort of the counterpart of the Muslim Brotherhood. And this one came in 1941, the Jamaat al-Islami. And they are opposed to the westernization, and all Muslims that part of the world are, because Americans and Western people are corrupt. They allow immoral things, unchecked stuff, the rule of the people. And in Islam, it's not the rule of the people, it is rule of God. It is Allah who made the law. It is not the people who make the law. Therefore, you know, again, this divergency. And the thing that we're looking forward to here is the reestablishment of the caliphate, but not the caliphate of Islam, of ISIS, see, because they're too radical. They're more radical than the Muslim Brotherhood and the others. So they exist way over here on the right, but they have claimed the caliphate. But nobody paying attention to them other than the members of ISIS. There is no leader, see. And that's a good thing, I think, at this particular point. But, okay, we've got these two major groups, and the Muslim Brotherhood has been very active in Gaza, and they've been active a lot of places like the United States and other places of the world. There is another group that you may have heard. Have you heard about the Hamas? Hamas is a Sunni group, okay? Sunni. They established in 1987 as the Palestinian Islamic group. They had grown out of the Muslim Brotherhood, which was an old Egyptian thing, and they became active in Gaza somewhere in the 1950s, and they now control Gaza. The Palestinians in Palestine are separated by the territory of Israel, and there's a group over in Gaza, Philistine territory, and then there's a group over on the West Bank. And they don't have any bridge in between. And Abbas, who is the president of the Palestinian organization, only has the West Bank because the Hamas, won in a democratic process, that is voting, came into position. I don't know how much hanky-panky went on there, but they came into position and they rule Gaza. They're, keep in mind, Sunni. There are the Shias now. We've talked about the Sunnis over here, and now we're talking about the Shias for a moment. They do embrace several beliefs, some of schools of jurisprudence, which would be different. The three branches are known as the Twelvers, where the evaporation of the 12th Imam versus the minority Ismaili group, which believed in only seven Imams, and that one is coming back again. And there's even another group like down in Yemen which have dispute over the fifth Imam. So they can't exactly agree which Imam went up and which one's coming back, but they all cut off there some way. This is only to show that the Shias are probably no more organized together and in agreement with each other than the Sunnis. But you should be aware, if you have in your presence somebody to come and address the audience who takes very liberal positions, be aware, these individuals are just one voice and really a minority voice. They do not represent Islam. So you hear everything from extremely strict to very liberal. And, you know, somebody who's uninformed goes and listens to one of these more liberal-minded, and you think they're just like we are. They assimilate, and they are good Americans. They participate in all the things, and yeah, okay, maybe they do, but they don't represent all of Islam. And don't be confused also with the American brand of Islam. Now, most of Islam that we're hearing about in America is not the American brand. The American brand would be, well, starting in American history, we've had Muslims from slave days, because a lot of Muslims were slaves. Tribes in Africa would conquer another tribe. They'd both be Muslim. They would take them and kill them. And then when they found that the British would buy them, then they captured them. They took them down to the coast, sold them to the British. British put them on ships, bring them over to the New World, and sell them then as cargo in the New World. But they came as Muslims. So Islam in America has been around a long time. They were very often, you know, most of them were converted to Christianity, even though we had slave days and segregation days. But then there were some other efforts that started in the 1900s to revive, bring back, start a new group, an American group, mostly black groups, with all kinds of ambitions and mixtures. And have you ever heard of Farrakhan? Farrakhan has as much Christian thought as he does Muslim thought. He does not represent Islam, but he comes across as an Islamist. And it's within that prison system where these are mostly active. I got to stay out of American history. Let's come on down. I just say, be aware when you hear of a Muslim group, ask a question, where are they from? What do they believe? What kind of school do they submit to? What are we talking about? What are we dealing with? There are also secular Muslims, just like there are secular Christians. I mean, they don't profess, they don't go to Friday prayers, they don't go on a Hajj, they don't do anything else, but they just classify themselves as, well, I was born a Muslim, therefore I guess I am. And so they may not take any interest at all in some of the problems that exist, the tensions that we sense. So when we began to judge Islam in our world and in our country, we've just got a lot of questions to ask before we jump to conclusions. Now, what did I have here? Whatever. This way, this way, this way. Okay, that's all right. Now, let's look at the Middle East for a moment. Take into account everything that I've said to this point. Now, let's draw the map. Iran, Shiite. Thinking of everybody else as being apostate, right? Lebanon, now jumped over here, and these are Shias as well. Syria, the leaders of Syria, the president especially and army, they are Alawites. Well, Alawites are a skewed, very skewed group who came out of the Shias. But the fact that they came out of Shias continues to put them in the Shia camp. Iraq, southern part, Shia. Most eastern part of Saudi Arabia would have a few Shias. Nothing to be concerned about there. But look at the strip across here from Iran to southern Iraq to Syria to Lebanon, Shia country. Now, we've got the northern part of Iraq. It's got two groups of people, Arabs and Kurds. And the Arab folks are Sunnis, and so are the Kurds, by and large. And then you've got, so across northern Iraq, you've got Sunnis. Up in Turkey, you've got Sunnis. In the Asian, Central Asian states, you've got Sunnis, and then they're mixed with Sufis over here on the far extremes. Now come down to Egypt, you're dealing with what used to be a Shia, but is now a Sunni place. And Yemen, we've got this group down there now who are Shia, who are fighting that the Saudis are bombing, okay? And then you got the rest of them are Sunnis. And then you got ISIS that is more Salafist in its approach and more literal in its approach than even Saudi Arabia, which Saudi Arabia is afraid of. And then you got the Kurds that are in four or five different countries up here that the ally, I got to go back just a moment, just one moment, go back. How did these countries come into being? The brief part of that story is that after World War I, France and Britain became the proprietors, the administrators of that part of the world. And then coming after World War II, and after World War II, some divisions were made and country lines were established. So the French and the British, America was not really fully into this thing by that time, but they were pretty well responsible for drawing the lines and making the countries what they were. The old Ottoman Empire disappears in World War I because they decided with the Germans, and the Germans were defeated. So the whole empire is ended. Now you cut out of that territory certain sections and call them countries. They're manufactured countries, and they're created by the West. And so Iraq especially. And in the drawing of the line of Iraq, the principals involved did not want the Kurds to have their own country. And so some of the Kurds were put up here in Turkey, and some of the Kurds were put over here in Iran, and some of the Kurds came over here in Iraq, and then there's another country over here, a small country, in which there are the Kurds. So the Kurds are separated, mostly Sunni, but they have wanted to get together. They wanted their own country. They're not Arabs. Now, the Iranians aren't Arabs. The Iranians are Persians, the Turks are Turks, the Arabs occupy much of the other group. So you got this ethnic group, you got the religious group, you got the power hungry, and then you got the rest of the world trying to manage it all. And so America and Britain against Russia, see? You got everybody's got his finger there with some kind of cause, trying to bring unity to a world that is divided religiously and politically, and, you know, it's a mess. And the answer to the question, I haven't heard any presidential candidate or any president of the past several that we've had to have a legitimate answer to the problem that to some extent was created by the Westerners. But don't blame the West for everything, because the West can't solve the problem. And the Muslims evidently will not change. And by the way, there's Israel in the middle, which is a whole other story. The land that was given to Israel was occupied by Arab Muslims when the United Nations decided to partition Israel because Israel was so hurt during World War II and the Holocaust, and they didn't have a land, and it's a mess. But it's important for us to realize that as we look at the events on our news, that it's not as simple as the politicians would leave us to believe. Now, some politicians would say, okay, we got a problem. We're just going over and kill them all. Is that a feasible answer to it? Just kill them all. Kill all of ISIS. Get rid of them, right? You don't change people's minds that way. You can't. We could have solved the problem of the Civil War if all the Southerners had been killed, right? Or if all the Southerners killed all the Northerners. That wouldn't have solved anything. It's just been more bloodshed. Or somebody says, okay, all of those come over here, we're going to send them back home. You'll send that many people back home? To what? What are the Syrians going to go to? Because all of the people involved in the bombing, as well as ISIS, as well as the rebels, as well as Assad, have destroyed families, homes, jobs, way to make a living, it's all gone. What are you going to send them back to? So listen very carefully when you hear the news of the solutions to the problems that seem to be so simple, but are really so complex. Now look at it one more time. We've got Iran. Iran is Persia. That's the Greek title for it. Iran is the original title. For 2,500 years, it's been a power. America's been a power. How long? Yeah, you figure it out. I was in Romania. Where are our Albanians here? I was in Romania one time on an airplane, and the fellow looked at me and he said, the United States is just a baby. What do you mean? Well, I said, Romania's been here 2,000 years. You've been in existence 200 or 300 years. So here we've got Iran, which has a glorious history. Are they just going to roll over and play dead? Now, pour into that their Shias, who don't think too well of the Sunnis. And by the way, the Iranians don't think much of Arabs either. They've got a list of priorities, and the Arab is at the bottom. Even the United States ranks higher than the Arabs. So you've got history, you've got ambition, power, you've got pride, you've got maybe some ambitions to extend the territory. I don't think the Iranian people would support that. I really am not that fearful of Iran from its people. How much they can marshal, I don't know. But you have to look at the leaders and where the power is to figure out what kind of problems you may be having. It's not going to come from the people in general. But here is Iran. Now here's Turkey over here that is a great power. And it was the king of everything because it had the whole Ottoman Empire. They came out on top as much as anybody could with the distribution of land, but they're Turks, and they have a past too. There's the center of the old Hittite Empire. And then you've got the smaller states that are just hoping against hope that somebody won't overrun them like Jordan. But you can imagine the fear when ISIS begins to develop and run toward Iran and could possibly... They're not the friends of southern Iraq or of Iran because they're Shia and ISIS is Sunni. They're not the friends of the Kurds. Nobody's a friend of the Kurds. And then you got Saudi Arabia, who's got so much to lose, and although they share together much ideology, Saudi Arabia runs scared of ISIS. And then you got all the other players that are there. You got Israel. But just look at Syria, for example. You got Assad. Be aware, I realize I'm running a little over and I apologize for that, but somebody told me to come when I came in to go ahead and go over that those who wanted to go home and watch the widescreen were free to go. but here is, you know, we rejoiced. This is the thing that bothers me, you know, is the whole attitude toward taking out leaders. But we rejoiced when we saw the Arab Spring. Because we saw some notable bad guys get kicked out of office. But let me tell you that the key to an Islamic state has always been, for 1400 years, a strong leader. And since Islam is in opposition to democracy, there is going to be the opposition from the religious point of view, but there's also going to be the opposition from those places under those concepts cannot be run by democratic processes. Where when there's a funeral of one of the presidents, all the other presidents come together. No, in those situations, they are either dead or in jail. Now, we may think Gaddafi and Hussein and other leaders you might come to mind, including Assad, they're not necessarily good folks in terms of the way they handle the population. But in the Arab Spring, they had their thumb on the place. And Marty's been to Egypt 26 times and has worked in relation to undercover people as well as to people in government and people in business. And we know about Mubarak. Mubarak, he was not a bad leader. He took after the Muslim Brotherhood, outlawed it. He was able to step in when there were these revolts. Was he a perfect guy? No. But who is? But he kept his thumb on it. And look what happened when he was taken out. Look at what has happened to Libya when Gaddafi was taken out. Only Tunisia really has been able to cope. Efforts in other places in the Middle East, in Iran or in some of the Gulf area, they were not successful because the leaders were strong enough. But in Syria, it was a different situation. It was a different situation in many respects. But Assad now is the leader of the government, still is. But you've got several rebel groups. We don't know who all they are. Some of these rebel groups are associated with Al-Qaeda and an Al-Nusra group. They're Al-Qaeda kinds of folks in a loose association. So we got them, and we got other rebel groups, and we've got the ISIS, and we got the Kurds, and we got the Turks, and the Turks get involved in the war, and they bomb the Kurds, and those were enemies, and then we got Russia coming in and supporting Assad, etc. So just keep in mind when you listen to the news that there is more to the story than you are being told, and that the answer is much more difficult, and that all of the ways to try to solve that problem have, to this particular point, failed. And you ask why? And the answer is very complex. But it's not going to be solved with bombs, and probably not with negotiation. And it will not be solved until the people of that area come to grips with their own diversity and with their own ambitions. And as long as the West is making money off of the sale of arms, it will exasperate the particular conflict. We're all guilty. I wish I could have a good prediction about what's going to happen. I think the Lord's going to take care of things in time. And maybe our efforts are intended to fail. But I do want to end with just saying that there are a lot of converts among Muslims and countries who have given up on the religion. And these are the thinkers, and these are the people who are going beyond the rote quotations and are looking for something that is real and genuine. And they're not only looking at Christianity, they're looking elsewhere. They're looking to Buddha and Hindu and other aspects. But we have an unprecedented opportunity to help them and to spread the word. There's an international television program, non-denominational, that is being aired in Turkish, in Arabic, and in Persian. And this is Sat7. It's a television program which is based on Christian principles. And what they do is they do formats like a family together. They're showing to the Muslim world what a Christian family is like and how they behave and how they interchange with one another. And they will have programs for teens and for children and for adults and all kinds of programs of that sort. And it's having remarkable success in some areas of the Middle East. So much so that it's been reported, they reported that in Algeria some time ago, that the Algerian government warned their people not to listen to Sat7 because their children were listening to it. And that only feeds the thing. And some bright spots are being found in Algeria. Don't hear much about Algeria these days, but they went through 10 years of civil war over the government takeover of the extremists. But those are the bright spots that people are seeing the gospel and are responding to it. And we've seen in Nations University quite a number of students from Iran, and many of them having to leave and they go to other places. But the stories are heartwarming, just as the WEI stories are that you hear from time to time. So there is something good that's going on. Thank you so much for allowing me to come. I think we'll take two questions and then try to bring it to a conclusion. Yes.
Are you saying that you think those countries operate better under dictatorship?
Yes.
But us trying to enforce our values on
it? Yes. Our effort to introduce democracy to a place that demands strong leadership is going to always fail.
Because they're run by power.
They're run by power, but it's the concept of what Islam is.
Yeah.
See, Islam will not admit a parliament that makes laws that pertain to social problems or issues.
Right.
It's the concept that you're dealing with, and we've got to keep that in mind. It's not just religious. It's the whole concept of Tawheed, of oneness. One other question? One in the back.
What advice can you give to teachers in WEI who have Muslims?
Well, I would hope that WEI would deal with that, but I don't know. You're asking what we would tell, what we'd tell teachers?
Yeah.
Two things I would remark on here is, number one, if your student is in a Muslim-dominated country, be extremely careful about the language you use when communicating by letter or email to those students, because the information is filtered through the government, and they're looking for cracks in the armor so that they can call into account. So you start talking about Christ, and you start talking about church, and baptism, and things of that sort. You've got to use some synonyms. How's it with the company today? Did you go to work? And you and your audience then began to understand that you're talking code language, and that keeps them from unnecessary harassment by the government or being arbitrarily cut off. In terms of reaching those individuals, it all depends on the person. If the person is a searcher, the person is more open to anything that you would say that WEI would present. You're going to have a more difficult time if you're trying to crack the mentality of the person who is not dissatisfied. And there will be many of these who are looking for people who are trying to convert their people, especially if the gospel is being successful. The most successful work that is done in Muslim countries is by ex-Muslims themselves, by people who are there. And I'll tell you, there is a tension that you run into. Like in Egypt, you've got the older churches, the Evangelical Presbyterian, some of those have been there a long time, were authorized under Nasser. They are extremely careful about what they do, what they say, where they go, and who they admit into their assemblies. And so, because they know they have to report to the government any activity that goes on, and they know that they can be shut down immediately, driven out. They won't be persecuted necessarily, but they'll be shut down. Now, there are those who are converts who are more energetic and who want to teach everybody anywhere at any time. And I tell you, these two groups are at odds with one another. There's a conflict between them to preserve our place. And the other is, let's forget everything and suffer persecution. So, the answer is more complicated than we can really deal with. I must cut it off because we have a couple who have already left, and some of the rest of you need to go. But thank you so much for letting me be a part of your weekend.